You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Hey, listeners, and welcome back to National Security Law Today. Last week, Elisa sat down with friend of the cast and former CIA Moscow station chief Rob Dannenberg to discuss President Trump's recent summit with Vladimir Putin in Alaska. This week, in part two, Rob unpacks Ukraine's bold Operation Spiderweb, the tightly controlled news Russians receive about the war, and why Putin's grip on power may last longer than we hope. And before we wrap, Rob lightens the mood with stories from his new cocktail book, including the drink he'd serve Putin if given the chance. As always, thanks for tuning in, and here's Elisa.
So one of the things that's been interesting to me is despite Russia's behavior, Ukraine has sort of punked Russia during this conflict. How in the heck did a band of Ukrainians get inside Russia and wreak so much havoc while the Russians didn't even know it was happening? Can you talk a little bit about that intelligence operation?
Well, presumably you're referring to Operation Spiderweb, whereby the Ukrainians brilliantly planned an operation over the course of 18 months to infiltrate trucks carrying little portable cabins, and they get carried around in flatbed trucks. And, you know, people who can't afford to have a dacha constructed for themselves buy these little one-room cabins, and they get them set down on a plot of land that they own, and that becomes their vacation home. And it's all over that part of the world. And what the Ukrainians did was manufacture a number of these huts with roofs that would raise and release drones carrying 7.1 kilograms of explosives. And when the trucks got to the place where they were directed to go, the roofs would be triggered to open and the drones would fly out. The drivers that had been hired to carry these trucks didn't know what they were carrying. They thought they were carrying these little vacation cabins. They were given instruction that, you know, they were to go to this general part of the Russian Federation and they would be given a call where to stop, and that the people who owned the cabins would come and collect them. So the Russian truck driver, he's like, yeah, okay, whatever, I don't care, I'm getting paid, and would drive. And it turns out that these places where they're given an instruction to stop were near five Russian air bases. And so the radio signal went out and these cabins opened up and the drones went off and they were all controlled. I mean, each drone, I mean, I think there were 177 drones, were individually controlled by pilots back in the Ukraine, running off of cell phone networks, not the internet, so to speak, so they couldn't be jammed, or not off satellite feeds that they were, the Ukrainians were worried would be jammed by the Russians if they figured it out. And they were directed to attack planes at these air bases. And it's just absolutely a brilliant operation. You know, to this date, there's still some dispute as to how much damage was actually caused. Credible estimates say 20% of Russia's strategic nuclear bomber force, Tu-95s, were destroyed, along with a number of A-50 early warning aircraft, and a bunch of Tu-22s and Tu-160s, which are medium-range cruise missile launching aircraft, were destroyed as well. And the cost of these 117 Ukrainian drones was about $2,100 a drone.
Sounds like a bargain.
There should be a lesson there for the U.S. military, one would hope. But yeah, it was a brilliantly conducted operation. And of significance, one of the air bases that was attacked was the Belaya Air Base in eastern Siberia, 4,300 kilometers from the Ukrainian border. I mean, that's a long way.
That's a long way.
And to successfully execute the operation without having a single one of your operatives captured or killed. Of course, the Russians arrested some of the usual suspects and, you know, this, that, and the other thing.
But none, yeah, they've got to make a show, right? Somebody has to be blamed.
Yeah. So, yeah. there has to be somebody.
All right. So, like, one of the things that you hit on earlier was the lack of information. You know, we whine a lot in this country because we're all in sort of information silos. I try not to be, but I think most Americans, frankly, are. But that's spin, and it's not necessarily the same thing as what happens in Russia. What kind of information is the average Russian getting about the war? And is any of it true?
That's a really important question, and it's important for a couple of reasons. One is that despite the million casualties, the war remains popular in Russia. It remains popular in rural Russia because the stipends that are now being paid for Russian soldiers, volunteers, or draftees are extraordinary. And they have manifestly improved the economies and the standard of living for a number of people in parts of Russia that haven't benefited from any other part of Russia's wartime industrialization or pre-wartime prosperity. So the war is really popular with a lot of people in Russia. I think the second thing to consider, and it is absolutely underappreciated by anyone who hasn't lived in the Russian Federation, is the basic prejudice that the average Russian has against Ukrainians. You can go onto YouTube today and Google Russian citizen views of the war in Ukraine, and there'll be thousands of hits on man on the street interviews, and you'll be struck, I think, by the near universal expression on the part of the Russians interviewed of their contempt for Ukraine and their belief that Ukrainians are a bunch of hicks and farmers, and they can't understand why the great Russian army hasn't just swept these hicks and farmers aside and occupied. It's mystifying to your average Russian. Getting back to the front part of your question, is reinforced by the messaging that they're getting from the Russian media, which is, of course, state control. And the messaging is, we're winning. We're fighting NATO. So it's not just like we're fighting these Ukrainian hicks. We're fighting NATO. And that's why it's tougher. But we're winning and we're going to get there. And our leader is doing a great job. You know, the troops are motivated, this, that, and the other thing, which all belies the truth of the situation.
Yeah, there is going to come a time when a man like Putin in his 70s, who's exceeded the years that his father lived by, I don't know, more than 20, maybe 30, is not going to be around anymore. You know, it has tended to be the case in Russia that when one leader goes, another one arises in his stead with much the same Weltanschauung and attitude toward the United States. If Putin, for some reason, gets polonium-210 in his food and is gone, what do we have to worry about? Who do we have to worry about?
There's been people that have been speculating for years about Putin's health. And even after the Anchorage summit, there were all this commentary. Oh, he was limping when he walked onto the Russian plane. And he wore a blanket at the May 9th victory parade in Moscow. You know, I mean, there's all this. This is wishful thinking. I mean, Putin is 72 years old. He's a moderate consumer of alcohol. He's physically fit. He does still practice judo. He is in good shape. And he has far exceeded the actuarial life expectancies for a Russian male. Doesn't smoke, moderate drinker, as I mentioned, keeps himself physically fit, has the benefit of the best health care available in the Russian Federation. So I think any speculation at this point about a succession plan is premature. There is no clearly identified successor. The Russian constitution says that if the president dies or is no longer capable of fulfilling the office, the interim president is the prime minister, a guy by the name of Mishustin, who's a nobody.
You never even hear about him. I mean, he's
He's a former tax guy. You know, he's a placeholder until a new election can be held. So then what would you expect in that new election? Well, if this were to happen tomorrow, you know, I would say that you would see a very quick coalition of the head of the FSB, the head of the SVR, and the Minister of Defense come together and form a committee to guide the country until an appropriate presidential candidate can be found. There's a lot of speculation these days about the next generation coming along. Dmitry Patrushev, the son of former deputy head of the Russian National Security Council, former head of the FSB, as somebody that's being groomed as a possible successor of Putin. I think that's premature. There's also now increasing speculation about Putin's two sons, which are, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you know, anywhere from 13 to 18 in age, but have no public profile at this point, but they are the sons of the Tsar, as potentially in some years being put forward to succeed him. But it saddens me to say that Putin's likely to be around for a while.
Well, he's the devil we know at this point. At least, you know, we can profile and assess him. And it's hard to say when we have no idea who might come next. Could be worse.
Yeah. Anybody who thinks that when Putin dies, 10,000 democratic flowers are going to bloom in the Russian Federation and some new Nemtsov or some pro-democracy figure is going to emerge and capture the hearts of the Russian people and change, turn the whole thing around. I think that's as fanciful as anything you'd find on Walt Disney.
Okay. Moderate drinker, though he may be, let's talk for a second about this fun book that you wrote. And you wrote it with somebody, right?
Joe Mullen.
Joe Mullen was with you. I wanted to talk to you because it's fun. And you got some really nice notes on the book. People can find it on Amazon if you like to make a cocktail once in a while. But let's talk for a second about drinks and these leaders. Okay, Putin, you said he's a moderate drinker. Trump is a non-drinker. What drink would you make for Putin if you had an opportunity to sit down with him at a tavern here in Washington or anywhere in the world? And why?
Well, you know, you mentioned earlier a polonium 210. Absolutely what I would make for that guy. There's not a recipe for a cocktail in my book that calls for polonium 210, but
what is the stuff he gave Navalny?
Yeah, basically.
We give him a double dose of that, maybe.
We need a bigger dose. We'd have to do something better than just spread it around his underwear, you know, like they did to the
Navalny. And it can't squirt it in his ear like I guess the Israelis did with Khaled Michel, right? That didn't go so well.
There's got to be a better way to do it. But, you know, talking about a cocktail for a guy like Vladimir Putin, well, he's in his own way a traditionalist. You know, in my time in Russia, I spent 5 years there. There was never a time with the Russians when they made me a cocktail. The Russians drink vodka straight, which is actually kind of boring. And interestingly, and there's a story about this in the book, when you engage with Russians outside of the Russian Federation in an environment where, you know, maybe you're both assessing each other, trying to establish rapport, trying to get in a position to see whether you can maneuver this guy or take him down a path towards recruitment. And they're doing the same to me and I'm doing the same to them. You know, one of the things that I found more often than not is the Russians were really curious about American cocktails. And, you know, say, well, we've heard about bourbon whiskey and we've heard about whiskey, rye whiskey and this, that, and the other thing. But you guys, you have this culture of making drinks, of combining liquors. We don't do that in Russia. What's your most common drink, they would say? You know, is it a Manhattan? Is it an old fashioned? Is it a martini? I've heard about all these things. Would you make one for me? And I say, yeah, okay, well, we have a different drinking culture in the West than we do in the Russian Federation. You know, in many ways, we drink to sip and taste is important. You know, it's not Bolombay. It's not bottoms up every time you drink. It's, you know, you want to sip. And that's, cocktails are designed for that. They're defined for enjoyment and to enhance conversation. And that the Russians would get really interested, really curious. Okay, all right, great. I mean, that doesn't mean that you can't get yourself to the point where you're inebriated. It just takes a little bit longer, and it's a little bit more refined in the path getting there rather than the 8 or 12 traditional Russian toasts and bottoming up shots of vodka. And so, you know, what we found in the course of putting this book together is Joe and I picked half dozen or 8 or 10 stories of drinking episodes from various points in our career to illustrate how cocktails or alcohol had been part of the mission at the time. And we tried to inject in there also a little bit of humor, you know, drinking quotes, silly stuff, but we thought it was kind of funny. And Joe is a certified specialist in wine, so he wrote a chapter on the history of whiskeys and what whiskeys are all about. And I wrote a couple of pieces on some different other aspects of tools of the trade that you need for cocktails. And I don't know, it all seemed to come together in something that we thought was kind of fun. It's 130 pages, and so it's not a heavy read. You're not reading War and Peace, but you know, the feedback we've gotten so far has been really good, and it's for sale on Amazon, as you mentioned, Lisa, and that means Jeff Bezos is getting all the money, not me or Joe. I think it's quite possible that I financed his wedding in Venice. So,
oh,
Jeff,
yeah.
I'm sure I'll be getting a thank you note from Jeff
Maybe,
any day.
you know, there's already a pool going. We have a point spread on how long it's going to last, if you care to join.
Oh, no, I don't want to have to finance another wedding.
You may. All right, Trump, he doesn't drink alcohol. I don't know if he did when he was young, but, you know, he's made a decision that's not going to be a part of his life. What would you make him?
Well, I guess he had a family history of some troubles with alcohol. And so he just made a decision early on that that was going to be part of his life, and God bless him for it. And it's the same with his kids, as I understand. So he would be a tough one.
Shirley Temple. But
there's plenty of mocktails you can do out there. There's no recipes for them in the book. But yeah, you know, he's going to have a cheeseburger, right? So I'd probably serve him a Diet Coke. He's going to have a McDonald's cheeseburger for his meal with fries. You know, give the man a Diet Coke, right?
Just to offset, you know, I can't drink a Diet Coke, not with a gun to my head. I'd give up whatever secrets, anything, just not to have to drink a Diet Coke.
Maybe Coke Zero.
Coke Zero, whatever it is. I don't want it. All right. Well, I think it's been fun talking to you tonight. And I wonder if you have any predictions for what we should expect, I guess, in the next few weeks on the issue of the potential Russia-Ukraine so-called peace deal, or whether we're just going to be having this conversation again in a year when Russia's trying to advance even further.
I think my closing observation to you, Lisa, would be that my base case is that we're in for a long war and that we're nowhere closer to a negotiated solution than we were 3 years ago when the war began. But the sad part of that commentary on my part is that the horrible mathematics of war favor Russia, especially Russia with a leader like Vladimir Putin. I mean, if Putin has to expend another million lives of young Russians to achieve his goals in the Ukraine, he'll spend another million Russian lives and won't bat an eye about it because it's his historical legacy. Zelensky doesn't have that option. He can't do it. Ukraine is bleeding to death. They don't have the number of young soldiers, male or female, middle-aged soldiers in the case of the Ukrainian. I think the average age of a Ukrainian frontline trooper is like 43 or 45 years old, which is incredible. War is a young man's game, but they can't do this forever, which is why it's all the more important, I think, for the United States and the West to give the Ukraine the tools it needs to take the war to the Russian Federation, make the Russian people feel the price of the war. I mean, the attacks in recent days on Russian energy infrastructure are brilliant, but they're not enough. Maybe Lisa, I mean, when did we do our last conversation? A year and a half or 2 years ago? I don't remember. And I was probably saying the same things I'm saying now. And I hope that a year and a half from now, I'm not saying the same thing, because there won't be much left of Ukraine by then.
That's a terrible thought, but I'm glad you came in, even though we're ending on not the most optimistic tone. I'm really glad you came in tonight, and good luck on the book, which is called A Spy Walked Into a Bar, A Practitioner's Guide to Cocktail Tradecraft by Rob Dannenberg. And you can find it on Amazon. We can even provide you with a link in the notes to this cast. And I hope that we can chat again in a year and see where we are. And I want to keep a positive outlook here. I'm not going to go to the bottom on this, because sometimes there are things unforeseen that occur. And I'll hope for one of those that changes the trajectory of this conflict in a positive way for the Ukrainian people.
I want to end this by inviting you for a cocktail at the Fountain Inn on Wisconsin Avenue in Washington, D.C. That's something to look forward to, I hope.
That'll be our first live YouTube podcast for sure. All right. And thank you for listening to NSLT tonight. Be sure to share this episode with a friend. Like and rate us on your listening app of choice. Remember that we talk about things from all angles on NSLT. And we do this because we know that right now we live in a period of information silos and Americans aren't talking to each other. One of the greatest features of our national security is always going to be our unity in times of great divisions. So keep that in mind. Listen to each other. You'll be a better lawyer if you learn to listen to the other side. The writer, producer, and host of this podcast is me, Elisa Poteet, and I'm always here in my individual capacity. My co-producer is the ever lovely and indefatigable Holly McMahon. And my editor and my other co-producer is the lovely Frances Burkham, as well as all the members of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. We will resume our energy series next week, and we'll see you then.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.